Today's interview is with Kate Toon, and I'm really excited about this interview. Kate and I connected at We Are Podcast this year, and we're very much, so it appears from speaking to her, she's actually a Radcasters member, but, you know, having a proper conversation with her just one-on-one and telling her story, I really learned that we are totally on the same page, which is ironic because we're both writing books at the moment. What I love about Kate is she's kind of a bit like me in the respect that she's like not an anti-entrepreneur, but she's very much about doing things her way, not following a formula, not subscribing to other people's ideas of who she should be or the way she should run a business. She's very much on her own path, as am I, and I really value that in people when they can, you know, when they can connect to who they are and they're not afraid of that. So this is a great interview, really, and she tells this story, which I've heard before, about the Spanish fisherman. And listen, if you haven't heard it, but essentially she is the Spanish fisherman. She's the person who is doing it her way, regardless. And I dig the shit out of people who are like that. So I hope you really enjoy this episode. I'm sure you will. Let's dive in. Here's Kate Toon. Welcome to Carlosophy's Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralyzing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
Always difficult to know where to begin, isn't it? Yes, one should always begin at the beginning, but that would take you back to like me being a very small child, which is probably not that interesting. So I guess we could start when I went out on my own, which was about 7.5 years ago. So up till then, I'd been working in the advertising industry for a long time and hating life. I did like advertising when I started because it was kind of cool and trendy, and we got free booze on a Friday and we got to sit on beanbags and play on ping pong tables and stuff like that, which, you know, when you're 25 seems the height of any career aspiration you could have. But then as time went on, it's just an incredibly stressful environment working in an agency on deadlines and pitches. So I really was sick to death of it, but I could never have the chutzpah or the oomph to leave. I was too scared to leave. I did try a couple of times. I went off and trained as a masseuse.
Really?
I did. But then I realized that you don't just get to oil up hot young people. You have to rub the bellies of old flaky people. And it's actually very tiring and exhausting. And it takes a lot out of you. That wasn't for me. And I also had a very high-powered role at one agency where I was on the board and had share options and all those grown-up things. And I gave that up to go and work in Roses Only factory, packing roses into boxes. Because I just wanted a change of pace. And that was an experience, believe me. It made me realize how lucky I was to work in agencies where my fingers only bled metaphorically rather than literally. So yes, I tried a couple of times to leave, but I couldn't. And then I got pregnant, which was a surprise because I'd been told I couldn't have kids. So that was a bit like, wow, you know, this is obviously an opportunity to take a different direction. And I therefore gave it all up, which was hard because I was a contractor, so there was no maternity leave. I hadn't saved for anything because it was all a surprise. And I think at that time my husband had he's a French teacher. He had about 3 students, so we had nothing. Oh. And I was the breadwinner and I was paying for everything and I gave it all up and started my business when I was about 5 months pregnant, which is fun times, fun times. So, I had built myself a little blog and I just started doing everything and anything and, you know, building websites, writing copy, whatever it took to earn some money. Then obviously I had my little boy and pretty much had to start working straight away. So, you know, you'd be like sleep deprived and feeding with one boob and typing with the other hand. And it wasn't easy. I kind of, obviously you're so tired that you just kind of get through it. And it's all a bit, I barely remember it now. Like, people ask me, like, wasn't that really horrible? And I'm like, I can't remember.
Yeah. I remember enough not to go back for a second.
Oh, gosh. So tight. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's not going to happen. Although I would have liked it, but hey. Yeah. And then I just kept on keeping on. And over the years, gosh, you know, my business and my life has changed so much. We moved out of Sydney up into the Central Coast. So that was a big change of pace. And, you know, I sort of, the first couple of years of my business, I was just in business. You know, I didn't have a strategy or a plan, or, you know, I didn't have aspirations. I just wanted to work for myself at home. And then over time, that's evolved into lots of different things. And, you know, here I am today, kind of, I don't know where I am today. with 3 different businesses now and a lot going on. But I'm still working at home in my hut, and I still work on my own. And, you know, long may that last. I hope I never, ever have to return to corporate life, really. So, yeah.
So you're obviously not Australian in terms of your background. And your husband is French. So how the fuck did you end up here in your hut?
What do you mean I'm not Australian? Do I not sound Australian? I'm doing my best accent.
You sound like a very posh Australian, maybe from Adelaide or something.
Yeah, I know those posh Australians. I know a few of those. So I was born in a place called Crewe in near Manchester, which is famous for its railway station, which is pretty dang exciting. And then I moved down south to a place called Henley-on-Thames, which is very posh and hoity-toity. So my accent morphs depending on who I'm talking to. I can sound very, very northern when I'm talking to my mum and dad. And then very, very posh if I'm talking to someone quite civilised. I moved over here as a backpacker when I was 25. We were going to travel all around Asia, me and my friend. She was a bit of a loon, to be honest, and she got drunk on a beach in I think it was Koh Chang, and ran off with a Thai man who was amusingly called Bang. And so her and Bang banged off into the sunset, and I was left on my own. And I was petrified because I'd never really gone abroad. This is pathetic, isn't it? I'd only ever gone to Wales, which, if you've ever been to Wales, it's not particularly exotic and challenging. So, you know, I'd never travelled. I definitely never travelled solo. So I came to Australia where I had one friend and got a job very quickly. I got a job at Ogilvy, which is a big agency, way above what I was actually capable of doing. I kind of blagged my way into it and then horribly regretted it. I was like head of the digital department, head of digital production. And I was a backpacker. I actually had no shoes. I remember this because I had no money. And I rang my dad and said, "Dad, can you lend me some money?" He said, "If I lend you money now, you'll only need more money later." So he basically just said no. So thank God. No money, and I had to start this job with flip-flops that I'd bought in Thailand because I couldn't afford. I bought a $9 skirt from Portman's, and I went in my flip-flops, and I remember the first day I had to walk into, like, there's a big room where a big room where all the meetings used to happen every morning, and the entire staff of Ogilvy would be there, including John Singleton, who owned who was a terrifying man.
Yeah.
And I rock up late on the first day in flip-flops and a Portman skirt and go through the wrong door, so they actually walk out behind John Singleton as he's delivering a speech to the entire room of people. Literally, even thinking about it now, I can feel my insides just cringing. And I wore those flip-flops until I got paid, which was 4 weeks later, and my feet actually started to rot on the top. That's how
Jesus.
A horrible story. Why am I telling you this? But I think I was just so poverty-stricken. And then I got my pay packet, and it was awesome, and I was rich. And I have no idea why I've gone down this tangent. I was telling you about my husband. And so I worked at Ogilvy for many years as a producer, and then I flipped over to being a copywriter. And then I actually went back to England with a bloke. Well, a bloke went back and I followed him foolishly. Was there for about a month and thought, what the heck have I done? Like, why did I leave Australia? It was a mistake. I need to go back. Thankfully, I had permanent residency, so I could go back. So I promptly broke up with said boyfriend and basically saved money as quickly as I could to try and get back, which took me a couple of years in the end because I'd racked up a bit of debt. And then literally probably about 3 months before I left, I met a handsome Tunisian man in a club in Brixton and told him that I was leaving to go to Australia so we could have a fling, but it would never be a thing. And
I like that.
Yeah, and I think that kind of made him think I was terribly exotic and cool, which I said I was going back, and I stuck to that. And then he asked if he could come with. So we went via Thailand and we cycled from Phuket to Bangkok together and did Vipassana meditation retreats and Thai boxing and then landed in Australia. And he, you know, we've been here ever since pretty much. He had to go back for visa reasons. But yeah, we've been here ever since, and which is now all up about 16 years. But we came back here in about 2005, I think. And now we have a little boy, so I think we're stuck here now. Wouldn't go back now, I don't think. So, yeah.
Do you go back often?
Not really. We it's so expensive.
Yeah.
I think of 3 plane tickets, and then because we both work for ourselves as well, there's no holiday leave, and obviously the mortgage and everything needs to be paid for. So it's just prohibitively expensive. So luckily, my mum and dad and his mum pop over every year, so we get to see them. But also, I'm not that bothered about going back to England. If I was to go back to that part of the world, I'd want to go to like France or Italy or Germany and, you know, do something a bit different. So hopefully it'll happen. But yeah, we haven't been back for about 3 years.
And so advertising, can you tell me how you got into that? Were you like, was that what you dreamed of when you were a kid?
No, gosh, I think I wanted to be a teacher when I was a kid. And then I went to university, I did English Lit and History. So I can name every Roman emperor and read you poetry, but it was absolutely no use vocationally because people didn't really do vocational degrees back then. It wasn't really a thing. Well, I didn't anyway. It was all about doing arts and stuff.
Yeah, I did arts.
So I left that and I was, after university, I was very into writing. So I used to write a lot for music magazines and I used to interview like bands like Pulp and Blur, which probably no one heard of, but yeah. And Radiohead and people like that. And the hangout with the bands and go in their tour vans. And it was all very cool. And then I got a brief sort of writing job at NME, which was an English music magazine, and that's what I really wanted to do. And I wanted to go on and do a postgraduate in magazine journalism. That's what I really wanted to do, and I got accepted, but I didn't have the money. I couldn't do it. I ended up getting a job instead at the NHS, which is the National Health Service in England. It's a hideous job.
Wow, that is like polar opposite.
I just couldn't afford it, and I watched 2 of my mates go off and do it, and now one of them is the editor of The Observer and one of them is foreign correspondent for The Times. So that's a little bit gutting. That's one of those things in life where you think, dang. But so I just took a very long route to get back to writing, and I went to events. I worked in events for a long time, a couple of years. And then as part of one of the events, we built a website, which sounds totally normal, but this was 1997, 98. No one had a website.
Yeah.
We didn't even have email.
I think I had a Hotmail account in 97, but
I don't know. Got mine. I'll have to check. That's an interesting question. I'm going to go and check that after this. But yeah, we still had those envelopes where you put a piece of paper in with a memo on it and you passed it around the office and people signed it when they'd read the memo.
I worked in a radio station. We were still doing that in 2003.
You still do that now. Come on.
It's a bit hard with, you know, put it in a thing, send it off to the Philippines, send it off to Clune, send it off to Colleroy. Make sure the whole team signs it.
Well, at least you knew people had read it. It was, I don't know, those were the days. So, yeah, we built a website for one of the events, and then the company that built the website, I actually ended up going to work for them. And the first big project I did was to build the Marks & Spencer's e-commerce website, which is the one they have today, actually. It was the first ever e-commerce site in the UK, which is, you know, quite a big deal to be able to buy things online. You know, now it's the norm. And that, it was a huge learning curve. You know, I remember going in on my first day and someone saying, which browser should we be viewing it in? because then it was like IE and Mozilla, and I was like, what's a browser? And I kind of, I'd given away the fact that I had no idea what I was talking about. So yeah, I did that for a couple of years before coming to Australia. So, you know, oh, and I did have a brief job at a weird advertising agency where my role was PA to the creative director, who was like Don Draper on speed. And he used to just make me, my main job was to light his cigarettes for him.
Oh my God.
That was my job, and to put them out. They had glass stairs. I remember they had glass stairs so that the guys in account service could watch the women go upstairs.
Oh my God, that is so disgusting.
Thankfully, he got fired actually after a while, which was interesting, and watching him being walked out. But yeah, that was my first experience of advertising. It put me off for a few years. And then Ogilvy, I think, was the first proper ad agency I worked at. So, but no, it was definitely not a desire, a dream. I mean, I think advertising always has felt a bit glamorous. And I think I always leant towards writing and creativity. Like, I never wanted to be a doctor or an engineer or a scientist. I was never mathsy. I was always more writing focused. But I think it's really only now that I'm actually doing what I want to do, which is a bit more creative writing. It's business creative writing, but by creative, it means I get to set what I write about and I get to write what I want to write. It just has a bit of a business tilt to it, you know?
Yeah. So I have to say, I am like super envious because when I was growing up, I used to read Beat magazine in Melbourne, and I used to always want to be a journo who interviewed bands and musicians and stuff. So like, can you talk to me about that? I just want to live vicariously for you, you for a few moments. What led you to that? How did you fall into that role?
I think at university I was a different creature. I don't know what, I mean, I think, you know, you leave home where, you know, you've grown up with the same people and you are who you're going to be because people have decided, and then you go away to college and you get to be who you want to be. And I think it gave me a whole new lease of life, and I was just really confident, and I just got involved with a lot of stuff. So there was a radio station starting off at our university, and I signed up to be a DJ. I knew nothing about being a DJ, but I did it. And there was a newspaper, and I signed up to write articles and reviews, and then I became features editor. It was quite I went to a university called Leeds, and the paper there was quite respected. I mean, we had our own office. There were like 30 staff. It was like a proper thing. Do you know what I mean? And as I said, many of the people from there have gone on to have hugely successful careers because it's kind of one of those stepping stones. I had no idea about that. Like, lots of people had chosen that university for the newspaper so that they could use it as a stepping stone in their journalism careers. But I'm always one of these people who just kind of, I don't know, falls into things, or opportunities arise and I take them and then see where they go. So, you know, with that Leeds Student Union press card on me, I would go to a gig. You'd get free gig tickets because they needed a review, and then you just go up to the guy at the back and say, hey, I'm from the newspaper, I've come to interview Bob, or, you know, can't remember their names now, the dude from Blur, Jarvis Cocker. And they'd say, okay. And you'd just be pushed through into a room where they were all drinking and smoking pot and doing
snorting lines.
Snorting lines. I never saw any line snorting, I must admit. It was much more pot when I was around them. And you just get to talk to them, you know. And sometimes it was great. Like the guys from Blur, like Damon Albarn. Oh, my God. So handsome. That was one of the best moments ever. I got to dance with him and everything.
Oh, my God. Oh my God.
And but, you know, the guy from Radiohead was just totally weird. I mean, this was before Radiohead were Radiohead. It was like a back room in a pub with 10 people in it. And then, you know, the guys from Oasis I got to meet. And it was great. It was so amazing. And I just had balls, you know. I remember once I was in a shopping centre, and Bob Monkhouse, who you probably won't have heard of, but he was a big TV celeb in England at that time. Like, he presented all the quiz shows, and he'd be like that dude here who presents Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, like that level.
Eddie Maguire.
But a lot nicer and funnier, and not Eddie Maguire. But he would be like him, and he was huge, you know, hugely famous, like a TV personality. And I remember seeing him in a shopping centre doing a signing and just walking up to his agent and saying, can I interview Bob Monkhouse? And her saying no, and then Bob Monkhouse seeing me and saying, it's okay, and then having an interview with Bob Monkhouse, which was huge. And I would never dare do that stuff today. Like, I would never, I wouldn't talk, I don't know who I was. Who was that person? Where did she go? She's gone. But it was good being her when I was her. But now I just couldn't be bothered, I don't think. more balls and bravado and energy, as you do when you're 21 and you think the world is your lobster, you know, you can do what you want. So
yeah, for sure. In your email to me, you know, in the correspondence that we have prior to the show, you mentioned being an anti-entrepreneur, and I can already see how you are.
Really? Okay.
But let's just explore that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess since, you know, you and I recently attended the We Are podcast event.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the last year or so, I've done a lot more public speaking, and therefore you get to mingle with the other speakers who are obviously fabulously successful, way more successful than I am. And, you know, they are what you would class entrepreneurs. And some of them, I think, you know, they wouldn't call themselves that. They're just business people. Whereas some people kind of shove that entrepreneur agenda right out in front. And while I don't think there's anything wrong with it, I guess in my opinion, remember the movie Wall Street and Gordon Gekko and Greed is Good and that whole mentality of the 80s to just earn money.
Success.
And I feel like entrepreneurism is just a modern hipster reinvention of that, because really all of them are talking about having a seven-figure income and a this, and you have to have a magazine and a podcast and a membership forum and a this. And, you know, there is very little in that entrepreneurism about, you know, I know Tim Ferriss talks about the 4-hour work week and having time to do your own thing, but the agenda seems to be that to be a success, you have to have these digits and you have to have this empire that you're building. And I just don't know if it's true. And I just don't know if it brings long-term happiness and that the success that actually feels good in your tummy rather than just in your ego, the ego blob in the back of your brain. So, yeah, I don't know. It's never been my agenda to build an empire or to reach a certain income level. I just want to do what I do. I want to enjoy it. And I want what I do to earn me money. And I want people to want what I do. But that's about it. And I just feel that so many of us are feeling pressure to not just be business owners, but to be these amazing entrepreneurs. You know, I'm making hand gestures right now. And you know, that feeling of we're just not enough, because whatever success we have, someone else has got bigger success. And I think, you know, as more and more people, and maybe especially women, I would say, move into having their own business, it can be really hard. There's a lot of pressure on women anyway to sort of do this and do that. But to put that pressure on top of yourself as well, I think is exhausting. So, yeah, I guess my ethos, if I have one, is that you can be a bit of a, you can kind of be an entrepreneur, but on your own terms. And you don't have to follow that traditional route, and you don't have to do all the things, and you don't have to have a giant team and a warehouse in Surrey Hills with beanbags. You don't need to do any of that stuff to be happy and to have a good life and to have a good business that helps people. Do you agree?
I mean, that's part of the reason that I started this whole podcast was because, you know, I had been building an empire and you know, it failed miserably. and it left me feeling a bit of a failure, you know, because I had taken it really, I don't know, personally, and I had allowed all that stuff and external success really define my value as a human being.
Yeah.
And I find like there are so many people out there who are following the path that they think they should be following and not necessarily following what's really, you know, they're looking externally to be validated as a person. And that means having a successful business, turning over seven figures. But, you know, those goalposts always move. Mm-hmm. And if they're always moving, maybe it's not the goalpost that you're after, you know. I think it's really important to define what success means to you, because it's generally, and that's why I ask this question when we get to the on the couch section of every guest, because how people define success when they're talking to me about it, it's not anything to do with driving around in a BMW and wearing, you know, expensive heels and being seen. It's not the stuff that we see. It's what they feel. Yes. And it's generally comes back to connection, you know, spending quality time with the people that are important to them and doing something that feels of purpose to them. And if it's that simple, why are we fucking around with it?
I don't know. I mean, I think all of us, I think you have to be a very, very strong Zen human to not let external factors influence your feelings and behavior, you know, like to, you know, we talk a lot about not letting criticism get to you, but I think it equally as important, if not more important, is to not let flattery get to you either, not let your fans get to you. So don't be influenced by the bad or the good. Keep on going. So, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, that you get lots of people telling you that the thing you're doing is great, and therefore you keep on doing the thing because the people are telling you it's great. But do you still like doing the thing? Do you want to do the thing? Just because people want it, do you want to do it? So I think it's important to be not swayed by either side of it, but it's very hard. It's definitely not something I've conquered at all. I have my good days and my bad days.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, totally. I totally understand you. I'm kind of going through this moment right now, like today, where I've been searching for, not so much searching for my purpose anymore, but because I'm on purpose when I believe I'm on purpose, and I'm doing something of purpose, you know, and so Radcasters and my podcast has definitely been a big part of that, and figuring out who I am and what my message is. But I've today the last piece of the puzzle fell in.
Oh, how great.
I know. And so I'm like so excited to get this thing out into the world.
And it's, is it a secret?
No. So it's a book, but it's more than a book, because I feel like, you know, the last, what's it been, like 10 years, I guess, I've been on this journey of, you know, going through really pretty hardcore depression and anxiety. And then going over the last 10 years, I've really, you know, been learning who I am and what makes me tick and all that kind of jazz. And it's been a long time coming. But actually, you were a big part of this story.
Really?
And you don't even know it. So, what you asked when we were having dinner at We Are Podcast, it was you and me and Katie Wyatt, who I'm going to get on the podcast too, and somebody else.
Lauren,
yeah. And you asked that question. Do you know what the question was?
No.
So, you asked us if we were to be given an award.
Oh, yes. Oh, my question.
Yeah. So can you just share the question? Because I know I'll fuck it up.
Well, it's not my question. I have to admit that it's from Robert Gerrish, who hosts
the podcast. Oh, I love Robert.
I love, gosh, his voice. It's like butter melting over toast. I love it. But Robert and I chat occasionally, informally. He's like a wise old sausage that sometimes gives me advice, and I help a little bit with flying solo every now and again. And we had a chat, and he says a couple of good things. I've got another great one that he said that I might share with you later.
Yeah,
but
cool.
He just said, you know, I'm always like, because I'm like you, like, what am I doing? Why am I doing what I'm doing? Is this the thing I should be doing? You know, and that comes up a lot. Just self-doubt, you know, lack of confidence, anxiety. We all have those feelings, and however we portray ourselves publicly. And that Robert just said to me on a call one day, okay, just close your eyes, and your listeners can do this too. Close your eyes and think about you're walking up the steps onto the stage, and there's someone there with a microphone and a big award in their hands. And you look down, the whole audience is on their feet and they're clapping and they're cheering, and you walk towards the presenter who's going to hand you your award. What is the award for? And I think that was so powerful.
I know, it's so powerful.
So what is your award for?
So mine was the first thing that came to me before you'd even finished, which I always take as a sign, as that's like my intuition telling me. And it was like I expected it to be using my voice or, you know, communicating, because, you know, communication is one of my key driving values. I communication and connection.
Yes.
And so I expected it to be about communication. But instead what came to me was giving permission. And, you know, and then we went around the table and it was like writing and a few other things. I was like, please don't come to me. Please don't come to me. Because I'm going to say giving permission. And it seems so waffly and, you know, like, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, but I took it away from that. And I thought, oh, my God, that is what I do. That is who I am. Like, I am a permission giver. People come to me. And they ask me questions. They come to me when they have problems because they know that I'll just give them permission to figure it out. And And whatever that is, whether it's permission to walk away from the thing that they no longer want to do, but they can't admit it to themselves, whether it's like, you know, they want permission to start their podcast. And in fact, people want permission about the most ridiculous things. So today I just saw in one of the business groups that I think we're both in, business, a guy had written comment about how he wondered if it was too late at 10 p.m. to send their clients an email. Because people have their phone on and what if it buzzes and all that kind of jazz. And it's like, you know, people are seeking permission at all times. It's like, if you want to send that email, send the email. Like, you don't really need someone's permission. But I've found that my role generally has been as a permission giver to other people and also to myself. So, and I've been kind of toying with this book that I've been trying to write for a very long time, but the whole message wasn't there. I'd come up with this thing about showing up and speaking up because I feel like that's also, you know, who I am and what part of my message is, but it felt like it was deeper than that. So, yeah, so I just started my book and I've just, you know, I've just been brainstorming the topics and all that kind of jazz and, yeah, and it's permission.
Oh, fantastic. Well, you know that I'm writing a book as well. So I Yeah, so I wrote a post about it yesterday called "How Donald Trump Helped Me Write My Book in 7 Days." So you should check that out. But basically, I'm like you. I've been toying with the idea for years, marinating my idea. What happened was I spoke to a lady called Kelly Exeter, who is fabulous, and she just gave me a prod, and she's sort of kind of guiding me a little bit with writing the book. She hasn't actually looked at anything yet, but she, you know, we're working together. And she said, if you don't get me a first draft by Friday of this week, I'm going to donate $100 of my own money to the Donald Trump campaign. And she hates Donald Trump. I hate Donald Trump. And honestly, it was the most scary thing to think that I could actually contribute to that man's political career. So I wrote my first draft last week in 7 days. A similar theme to you, but it's different. Mine's, as you can probably have told, it's called Confessions of a Misfit Entrepreneur. How to succeed despite yourself. So it's all about that thing of, you don't need to do it like everyone else. You don't need to have nice hair and look like Amy Porterfield or do all your videos sitting on a sofa with your legs perfectly crossed in Jimmy shoes. You know, you can be a scruffy lump like me and still do fabulously well and have a nice life, you know? So, but I think writing a book and, you know, it really gets to the nub of who you are and what you are. I think it does take till now, till, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 42.
39.
You see, and can I say dick? Well, I've said it now.
Yeah.
I was a dick when I was about 25, and I was still pretty much a dick when I was 30. And I'm kind of a dick today, but I'm a dick who's a bit more self-aware, and I know who I am a bit more. But, you know, God, if I'd have tried to write something at 20, what would it have been full of? Just nonsense. So I think I needed this time to kind of actually work out if I had anything interesting to say. And I'm not sure I do, but I'll find out when I publish the book.
And I think often, like, you know, we can't be judges of our creation either, you know. That really comes down to the people who are reading the book, you know. So to criticize our own work straight off the bat, like, people always ask me, how do you record your podcast? Just like going to the beach and pressing record, having no idea what you're going to talk about, and then put that out into the world. It's like, because I don't judge my own creation. I create for the sake of, not for the sake of creating, but in service, you know?
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like, I just trust that whatever comes out is what somebody else needs to hear. And that's why I've turned up and pressed record on the mic. And I just trust that that's the way it's going to go. But then, and I often listen to, well, actually, I listen to every single episode that I record, because often the message is actually for myself. Because we teach what we need to learn a lot of the time too, right? It's not like, we're teaching anything new. We're teaching the lessons that we've either learned or we need to learn.
Yeah, or relearn, exactly. And I think as well, you know, with writing a book, with recording a podcast, because I'm hugely, I love my podcast. I love it. I don't love it because other people love it. I love it because I enjoy doing it. And that's one of these things, again, when people are looking at stats and, oh, how many downloads have you had and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't even look. No, I don't really honestly care. Because even if like one person downloads it, maybe two, because one would be my mum. And then, you know, it's one person in that, and having a podcast, it goes straight into someone's ear hole. It's such a connection. I mean, some of the people I listen to, you know, day in, day out, I would kill for them. I love them, you know. And the same with a book. You know, you write a good, decent book that, you know, is not just one of those, I wrote it in 2 days and got it on the Amazon bestseller list, two blogs stuck together, ebooks. It's actually a spooky book. You know, someone's going to take a good, you know, 3 or 4 weeks to read that off and on the bus, in the bath, before they go to bed. And, you know, that's a very intimate relationship to have with the reader. And that's what interests me. You know, I love that. I love that. You know, you talked about connection and communication. I think it will still be a big theme of your book. But, you know, because it's, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think that connection is, it's better than a nice review or even a negative review. It's a deeper thing than that. It's like you've really, really connected. I should have better words because I'm a writer, but I don't. You're saying connected. Connected and dick are my words of this podcast. You can put that in a meme.
Love it. Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes. Just the two words that just sum it up, connection and dick. You listen if you're interested. So I'm curious, what was the other thing that Robert Gerrish told you or asked you?
Again, I won't say it as well as Robert did, but it was the analogy of the Spanish fisherman, which I may have told you on the podcast, because what I like to do is regurgitate Robert Gerrish's wisdom as my own, but I do always give him credit. But again, he's like, you know, you can do all the things. Here are all the things you can do. And people are always coming to me and saying, do you want to do this thing? Do you want to do that thing? And it's great. And I welcome the lovely opportunities that people put in front of me. But also they throw you into like a paralysis of indecision and should I do it and is this right and his analogy was, you know, there's a happy Spanish fisherman in a port sailing into the harbor with his boat full of fish, and there's an American tourist on the shore who goes, hey G, I'll do my American accent, hey G, you got so many fish. And the Spanish fisherman, I won't do my Spanish accent, but he says, yes, you know, there are fish every day, and so many fish, it's great. I fish all morning, and then I pack them up in the boxes and I go home and spend time with my family, and you know, it's a great life. And the American man goes, you know, yeah, well, you know what you could do? You could get a second boat. There's so many fish, you could actually employ another fisherman and he could get fish in his boat, and then he could bring them in. And the Spanish fisherman kind of nods, and then he says, and you know what you could also, you could get like a whole fleet of boats. You could have 12 boats all gathering fish, you know. And then how about you cut out the middleman? So, you know, you make your own boxes and you deliver them to your own canning factory and you process the fish, because if there's so many fish, you've got all, you could then, you know, corner the market and you would have, you know, your fish empire. And the Spanish fisherman was like, yeah, that would be good, but why would I do all of that? And he's like, well, you know, you'd be rich, you could spend so much more time with your family and doing the things that you want. And the Spanish fisherman says, but I spend morning fishing and I spend all afternoon with my family, so how would it be different? And it's like, it's so true. Like, I mean, I don't know if that resonates or made any sense.
No, totally. It totally makes sense. I've heard that story before and I love it. And, you know, I feel like you're the Spanish fisherman.
Oh, totes, I'm the Spanish fisherman. Jesus. Every day I consider getting that canning factory and then I pull back from it. Because my, you know, we're going to talk about fears and worries and stuff at the end. But one thing I said to myself when I started this business, and it's one thing that I want to stick to, and it's a negative thing in a way, but it's like, I never want to employ another human. I never want to be responsible for someone else's mortgage. Yes, I may use subcontractors. Yes, I may, you know, use suppliers. Sorry, that's my dog barking in the background. I apologize. He's in a different room.
That's okay. I've got like a truck just outside.
My dog's very vocal. I think he's actually in the kitchen. He's just very loud. But yeah, I never want to have another human that I'm responsible for. I don't even want to be responsible for myself, let alone someone else. So, you know, and I realize that there is only so far I'm going to be able to go just completely on my own. And therefore my struggle is the constant battle between what I want to make and who I want to be and what I want to produce and the time and capabilities that I have on my own. Because I think if I do start to build that team of hundreds of people, I'd be miserable, because I was miserable managing a team when I was in an ad agency, and it's just not what I want to do. So I am the Spanish fisherman. That's it. Very true.
You definitely are. So let's talk a little bit about what you're doing now. Like, you're writing the book. Let's talk about, you've got like, what is it, 2 or 3 podcasts now?
I've got 2. So I did have like three businesses. I had my copywriting business, which was a service business where I wrote copy for clients. And that's kind of what I built my business on. You know, that did very well and I ranked very highly and I, you know, got a lot of high profile clients and that was brilliant. And that's, you know, what I did for maybe the first 5 years of being solo. And then I set up a copywriting school where I taught other people how to do what I've done and gave them resources and tools. And I have a little membership area on that where copywriters can come and join and kind of get advice and stuff, like your Radcasters group.
Yep.
Yeah. And then I have an SEO course, which I guess is my flagship thing, which I'm kind of turning into more of an SEO learning hub. Oh, that sounds so cool, doesn't it? It's more than just a 6-week course that you do and then that's it. It's like it's a support for your SEO journey. Yeah, so that's my other thing. And I've basically got kind of a podcast that supports both of those. I've got the Recipe for SEO Success show and then a show called the Hot Copy Podcast, which I record with Belinda Weaver, who's a copywriter over in the States now. So yeah, a couple of podcasts, a couple of membership sites, some e-courses, the book. That's enough. It's a lot. I don't do much day-to-day copywriting for other people anymore because I found that I was just kind of doing it, but all the while I was doing it was itching to write my own stuff. So I feel quite proud of myself that I've, and you know, this is not for everybody, but because lots of people are happy being in where they are, but I wanted to move away from being a service-based business to being a product-based business and stop exchanging my time for money and instead exchanging things for money. I don't know why, but that's what I wanted to do, and I enjoy it a lot more. I enjoy just being able to get up in the morning and go, I'm going to make a thing today, and I'm going to sell it for $29.95, and someone might buy it. Yay, they bought it. Hooray, I'm happy. That's my day, basically.
That sounds pretty blissful, actually.
And you know, that whole, I call it the PayPal ping, and I cover this in my book as well. I think I told this little story that I was staining my deck and listening to podcasts all the while, listening to, I think it was Serial or This American Life or something like that. And I had my phone in my bra, which I've since been told is a terrible thing to do.
Terrible.
I didn't know that, but so now I don't do that. But literally for this 1 hour, it was really weird. Every 5 minutes, it would just vibrate, which was kind of thrilling, you know, both ways. And it was because...
Should put it in your pants next time.
Totes. That might not be good either. But yes, it was the PayPal ping. It was people buying my stuff. You know, not that I'm all about the money, honey, but it is. I still get a thrill when anybody buys anything that I have made. And I know it's like a written thing or a digital thing. It's not something I've hand-sewn or carved out of, you know.
But you've still created it. And, you know, and love has gone into it and you have gone into that. So, you know, it's every bit as valuable as you know. I think we all create in different ways, right?
Exactly.
I've got one last question for you. So, you know, we're talking about the first question, the Robert Gerrish question.
Yeah.
What is your answer to that? What is your reward?
I think, you know, in deep down truth, it's probably for a young adult novel. It's for something totally creative, not business related. So it's, you know, I've written the next Judy Blume book or something like that. I don't know if you know who Judy Blume
is. Yeah, I used to have Super Fudge or whatever.
Super Fudge and Forever. I don't know if you remember Forever. It's very rude.
Yeah, yeah. I actually quite liked the rudeness. I think I had a bit of a sticky page there.
Do you remember Ralph? That was the name of the, anyway, the appendage. But anyway, you can go back and revisit that and remember Ralph. But I think that's what I would like. That's what my award would be for. But I'm happy to park that dream for maybe another 10 years because I feel like I want to make hay when the sun shines. My business is going great. This is the time for me. I'm not sure I'm going to be wanting to be recording digital webinars when I'm 59. You know, I just don't think that's who I will be. So, but I do like the idea of being sort of 55 or plus or whatever and writing young adult novels, hopefully with a little bit of money in the bank to support me doing it, you know. So that's my ultimate dream. But the sort of segue into that is just keep on keeping on. And at the moment, it's, you know, it's there's maybe not the award on the stage, but like some random woman on LinkedIn sent me a picture of her chomping through the Hollywood Hills and took a selfie of herself. And she was listening to the Hot Copy Podcast as she did it. And to be honest, that was one of the most thrilling things that has happened to me. To think that my boring little drone is going into people's ears all over the world, it gives me, I don't know, it gives me shivers. I think it's glorious. Yeah. So that's what my reward will be right now, I think. And then later on, the novel.
Time to kick up your feet and relax. It's On the Couch. Biggest fear?
It's not failure, it's actually success. So that's weird. It's like, you know, that something's going to go off in a direction that I don't want it to go, and I'm not going to be able to stop it. So that sounds weird, but yeah, it'd be success. That's terrible.
Yeah, and I think I actually have that written on my board. I've got permission to fail, permission to succeed. Which yes. one are you actually afraid of?
Yes. Well, I'm the second one, so I get ready to read that chapter. Thank you very much.
Cool, no worries. I'll do my best to serve you. So failure, speaking of that, what does failure mean? What does it look like for you?
I think, you know, it would be not being able to pay the mortgage. That's literally it. I want to have enough money coming in to just chug along. So if I ever had a terrible month, I don't know. Failure is a tough one because I've had so many failures, but they've obviously then evolved into other things. So, you know, I think my biggest failure would be that I can't keep doing what I'm doing. So, you know, whether I have some terrible accident or something awful happens in my business, that would be a failure. But I don't have any fears about sort of falling on my face because I've done that so many times. And I don't have any fears about launching something and it being a giant flop because, again, I've done that. But if I couldn't keep going and I couldn't pay the bills, that would upset me, obviously.
And what are you struggling with at the moment?
I'm struggling with building a team and the fact that inherently I don't want to have a team, but that I need a team. So I'm, you know, trying to use VAs and different people and getting the right relationship and finding a smooth way of working with people, letting my inner perfectionist go and realizing that it will get done. It may not get done the way I would have done it, but it will get done. That's my struggle.
And evil bitch, like we've all got one that's living in our heads telling us a bunch of untruths about ourselves. What does yours say on repeat the most?
That you're a fraud and that you don't know what you're talking about and that no one really thinks you're an expert in anything. You're just fudging along and someone's going to discover it. It's the classic imposter syndrome. Someone's going to realize one day soon that I actually have no idea what I'm doing.
And it's so funny because we I don't know, like I know because I've spent a lot of time with a lot of different people and I've done a lot of podcast interviews speaking about this stuff, but none of us have our shit together, right? Like
not one person.
Yeah, we all have no idea what we're doing.
No, we're just stumbling along and failing and failing and succeeding. And I think some people, you know, you do meet some people who do feel like they're a bit more zen. I always think when I meet Darren Rouse that he always seems very together, you know, like he's been doing this a while. He knows what he's got, his team, it's all. But, you know, even he has his challenges, so, and he freely admits them. So, yeah. We're all the same.
Yeah, we totally are. That's actually what I realized by speaking this year at ProBlogger and We Are Podcast, you know. Yeah, and sitting down with people like Darren, it's like, yeah, totally human.
Yeah, just fabulously successful and human.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And that's awesome because if it's possible for him, it's possible for us too. We just need to figure out what that looks and feels like for us. You know, we don't want to be Darren.
No, we don't.
And sometimes it's not even that we want the success that Darren has, you know. We want to be Kate or Carly doing our thing but being rewarded for that in the way that we want to be rewarded for that, you know.
I think that's exactly right. That's your last question, isn't it? How do you define that?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's go there. Well, how do you define, first of all, how do you define success?
I know I should have prepped for this answer and I do try to think about it. I'm going to just be honest and say I don't know yet. I don't know if I've got the answer to that. I define success as being able to have a nice day, being able to go for a swim, walk the dog, do some work, have a nice fun day, interacting with people online, on the phone, and then be able to pick up my son from school, make dinner and watch The Bachelor. That for me is a successful day. It's not, and that's what I want. I just want more days like that. That's all I want. It sounds so small, but that's what makes me happy, you know, simple, easy days like that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we think, I don't know, like, why do we think then that we, you know, our day needs to look like we fly into San Diego and we jump in an Uber and then we go and speak at this event and then we go and get interviewed on this TV show and then we, you know, and then we do a webinar and we make six figures from that webinar and then we, you know, and it's like.
And it's exhausting, you know, and I've done a lot of speaking this year and flown to a lot of events, but I'm a mum and I have a family and the logistics around doing that. Very draining. And I spoke to a guy called James Tuckerman at We Are Podcast, and you know, he said that he doesn't actually do as much speaking as he used to because it really messes with his adrenals, it messes with his sort of metabolic system, because you're so G'd up and then there's getting on planes and getting somewhere and then having to human for 3 days and talk to people and have breakfast with people, and you go back to your room for 2 minutes to sort of change your pants and then come back down again. And, you know, God, if I had to do that week after week, I'd go mad. It is not for me. So yeah,
it's nice once or twice a year.
Well, yeah, great, but I do not want to be on the speaker circuit, if there is such a thing in Australia.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, and I, you know, flying to San Diego would be great, but, you know, the anxiety that goes with that. You know, I'm semi-extrovert, semi-introvert, but I'm not a performer, and it is a performance getting up on stage and speaking to people. So, and you know, when there's those glamorous parties after events, I'm always in bed by like 10. I can't drink like I used to be able to. I don't sit and go to karaoke very often.
And it's not like the 90s, you know, interviewing musos. There's not, well, even then it was pot, so different, but like, you know, I don't know, in my radio days it was cocaine. So, or, you know, or speed or whatever it was. So at least then you had something to sustain you through.
A cup of green tea doesn't really cut it, does it? As far as I go now. So, yeah, I think it's just success for me is having a comfortable, enjoyable life, being able to travel a little bit and being able to get that, you know, I don't think work-life balance exists. Let me just say that for the record. But I think you can have worky days and then more family days and just be able to do the basic stuff, like occasionally turn up at my school's something at school, and you know, I can't turn up to every single one because I work, but you know, to be able to do a bit of everything, to be able to do that webinar and then go and cook spaghetti bolognese, that's my definition of success.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's why a lot of people are afraid of success, because it hasn't been defined for them, so they are thinking that it looks like, you know, catching the red eye to New York, and you know, so yeah
exactly. I don't want to buy a private island. You know, I'm happy in my own little island, which is, you know, it's pretty good here. Toon Island, you're welcome to pop over.
Fantastic, I'll be there.
The plug. Instead of filling the podcast with self-promotion, we're being totally transparent. Here's the plug.
Well, I think the easiest way to find me is, because I'm quite good at SEO, apparently, you can just type Kate Toon into Google and you'll find various bits and bobs for me all over the internet. So that's the joy of having a rather foolish name, which I hated as a child, but now I embrace fully. So, yeah, you know, lots of different sites you could check out, but if you type in Kate Toon, you're bound to find something related to me.
And, of course, they can find you in iTunes too. So if they're in here listening to us, just type in Hot Copy.
Hot Copy or the Recipe for SEO Success Show. So, either of those. That'd be great.
The takeaway. Exercises or tips for positive change, sprinkled with salt and vinegar, wrapped in newspaper and handed over the counter from our special guest to you.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a little bit hackneyed and a little bit overused, but I totally think it is about trying to be just, you know, be yourself. I know that's so upra. Not everybody likes me. Not everyone likes my sense of humor, my voice. You know, I'm sure some people listen to my podcast and go, oh my God. And people have actually said, you sound really northern and I can't understand what you're saying, which is like, thanks, dude. But I don't care anymore, because enough people do like me, and you attract the people and that you're meant to attract. And over, especially this year, you know, and I will put you on this list, Carly Nimmo, you know, the people I'm meeting are my people. You know, they're the people who I think are like me, like-minded, similar goals, not to up their own bottoms, and just cool people. But it takes a while for that to happen. And I think the only way it happens is if you truly are yourself as much as you can be, wherever you are, whether you're on Facebook, Twitter, at home, at work, at an event. Just be yourself, even if you're a bit boring sometimes. That's fine. Just be boring. Who cares?
Love it. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks ever so much for having me. It's been lovely to talk to you. I feel like we've just been chatting and having a cup of tea.
It's amazing. And now we're about to jump on and do a call for Radcasters.
I'm excited. So I'm glad to be a part of your Radcasters group. I've already had my little problem solved yesterday that I was screwing my brain up over. So it's a great little group, people. Join it today. Little plug there for Carly Nimmo, Radcasters. Be there.
Thank you again.
You can cut that bit out and use it as a promo.
Awesome.
Thanks for tuning in to the Carlosophies podcast with me, Carly Nimmo. Let's continue the conversation at carlynimmo.com. If you were a big fan of the podcast, I'd be stoked if you left a review. And if you want to hear more radness just like this, be sure to subscribe and spread the word. In the meantime, be real, be rad. Peace out.